You can be seated. And turn with me, if you have a Bible with you, to Proverbs chapter 7, where I have the unenviable task of preaching on sex. If you weren't here last week, let me tell you what I said then, that over this week and the next couple of weeks, we'll look at Proverbs 5 through 7. We've been in a series in Proverbs for quite a while, and there's no escaping it. If you're going to do any justice to the book of Proverbs, you have to deal with these chapters which discuss the right and wrong use of sex and sexual passions. So I warned last week, if you weren't here or you forgot, I warned this would be a PG-13 kind of message. We won't try to be unnecessarily crude, but the Bible is direct on this, and it's some racy material here in the Bible. So it may not be appropriate for young kids. If you have kids with you right now and you want to take them to a class or quickly grab earmuffs and put them on the kid, whatever you want to do to make sure you're shepherding your child on these issues, or hence want to answer a lot of questions later after the service from your child, that's all right too, I guess. I said last week too that these issues related to sex and sexual passion, they need to be talked about in the church and among Christians more than they are. For one, sex and romance and nakedness, they're in the Bible. Those things are discussed in their right use and their wrong use, their misuse. Solomon seems particularly keen on this topic. He wrote a whole book, Song of Solomon, about his romance with one of his wives. It kind of ruins it if you know that that's one of his wives, not his only wife. But read it in light of the romance with your own wife, and it is sweet. It's in Proverbs a lot. It even pops up in Ecclesiastes, a book he writes on the difficulty of finding satisfaction in this world. Sex is one of those things, too, that outside of Jesus, outside of repentance and restoration to God, nothing really fulfills. It's all grasping like after the wind, including sex and including, in Solomon's case, with many women, multiple wives. I'd like to talk about this broader issue of biblical sexuality for one more week than I originally planned. I want to take 2 weeks for us to talk about the misuse of sex, this week and next. Next week, I want to focus our attention on the nature of temptation and the strategy for fighting temptation for sexual purity. It's such an important issue, and it will relate to a strategy for fighting temptation in almost any area of life, any area of the Christian life, any kind of sin. But Proverbs 7 shows the nature of temptation in such a way that I think it deserves our single attention next week. Then 2 weeks from this week, we'll get to the good stuff, the proper place of sexuality, or the glory, the joy, the gift of the marital bed, looking primarily at Proverbs 5. So today I want us to ponder one of these things that's the misuse of sex, one of the things in Proverbs guarding us from the abuse of sex and the temptation within it. It's immodesty and temptation and lust. And I'll try to relate this to both men and women at different points, and try to relate this to married and unmarried people as well. If you want to follow along in the sermon notes page, the first thing we have to consider here is the significance of sexual purity in Proverbs. This is such a significant issue, and this is a bit of a repeat from last week, but it's again worth noting. Proverbs 1 through 9, you remember, is a preface letter to the actual Proverbs. When we say Proverbs, we normally think of those pithy little sayings of wisdom. Those don't actually start really until chapter 10. And then you have just one pithy little saying after another in chapters 10 and following. But Proverbs 1 through 9 is almost like a preface or a dedicatory letter from Solomon to his son or sons. And so much of it, Proverbs 5, part of Proverbs 6, and all of Proverbs 7, 2.5 chapters of the 9 chapters are about this issue. The second half of chapter 6, all of chapter 5, all of chapter 7 are about this issue. Guys, dads, imagine writing a letter to your son who's beginning high school or he's beginning college, and one-third almost one-third of your letter to him. It's a lengthy, heartfelt, plea-like letter. One-third of it is about sexual fidelity. It's about guarding him, warning him of bad girls, of the temptress. The significance of sexual purity in Proverbs is such that of the 9 chapters, 2.5 are given to this issue of guarding against a seductress woman. I want to read all of chapter 7. We'll look at bits of chapter 5, bits of chapter 6. We won't be able to look at all of them, but chapter 7, I think, paints the picture the best. Let's read it together. My son, keep my words. Treasure my commandments within you. Keep my commandments and live, and my teachings as the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers, write them on the tablet of your heart. Say to wisdom, you're my sister, and call understanding your intimate friend. So far in chapter 7, he said, keep the commandments, live by wisdom, keep hearing them, keep fulfilling them, keep them close to you, write them on your heart, write them on your mind, keep them near in your hand. Verse 5, why? That they may keep you from an adulteress. From the foreigner who flatters with her words. For at the window of my house, the dad is speaking now. He's recalling a story, something he has seen. I looked out through my lattice and I saw among the naive and discerned among the youths this young man lacking sense, passing through the street near her corner, her, the adulteress. He takes the way to her house in the twilight, in the evening. It's getting dark, in the middle of the night even, in the darkness. And behold, a woman comes to meet him, dressed as a harlot and cunning of heart. She's boisterous and rebellious. Her feet do not remain at home. She is now in the streets, now in the squares, and lurks by every corner. So she seizes him and kisses him. And with a brazen face, she says to him, I was due to offer peace offerings. Today I've paid my vows. Therefore, I've come out to meet you, to seek your presence earnestly. And I have found you. I have spread my couch with coverings, with colored linens of Egypt. I have sprinkled my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let us drink our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with caresses. For my husband is not at home. He's gone on a long journey. He's taken a bag of money with him. At the full moon, he'll come home. With her many persuasions, she entices him. With her flattering lips, she seduces him. Suddenly, he follows her as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as one in fetters to the discipline of a fool, until an arrow pierces through his liver. As a bird hastens to the snare, so he does not know that it will cost him his life. Now, therefore, my sons, listen to me and pay attention to the words of my mouth. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not stray into her paths. For many are the victims she's cast down, and numerous are all her slain. Her house is the way to Sheol, descending to the chambers of death. Well, chapters 5 and 6 describe scenes like this of sexual temptation. An adulterous woman, a temptress. Some commentators even describe her as a huntress. She's not just tempting, she's on the hunt, she's on the prowl. Chapters 5 through 6 describe adultery. The man is married and she is married. So two married people finding sexual passion outside of the covenant of marriage. The woman in this case is the pursuer in all three of the stories, chapter 5, 6, and 7. But the man is equally at fault and certainly more stupid throughout each of the stories. In chapter 7, it's slightly different. The woman's married. The man doesn't seem to be. Remember, he's a young man. The dad sees from his window a young man who probably doesn't even know where he's going, probably doesn't know that he's walking by the adulteress's house, and he becomes her prey, you could say. This is called immorality or fornication, but that's when a single person has sex outside of marriage. Now, adultery and immorality or fornication aren't exactly the same, but they are very similar, and the temptation to do it is almost identical. So whether you are a married person or whether you're a single person, and whether you're a single person that might sometimes be tempted to hook up at the club or hook up with a girl at the bar or to go home with a one-night stand, or you have a long-time steady girlfriend and you just keep pushing the envelope of your physical relationship, this issue, these chapters apply to you. And it also applies, it's not there in the text, but it also applies to lust, what we could call today virtual adultery, or virtual immorality, or virtual fornication. This is the internet, this is TV, this is magazines. Lust isn't new, but in our day, I can't imagine Solomon could have possibly conceived of what we have to face today with the temptation that is so readily available. And the battle has to be talked about. That battle has to be talked about. We have to talk about this issue, not just because it's in Scripture, and not just because we're sinful, and here's a corner of our lives where sin has touched and shown its ugly head. Like every corner of our lives, that's true. I don't think we're worse today than other generations. I don't think any generation is necessarily more evil than others. We can debate that if you'd like, but my point is this, even if we're not more evil sexually than other generations, we are more sexually obsessed. We are obsessed with sensuality and sexuality. So we need to remember, painfully remember, what Jesus said in Matthew 5, that if you've looked upon a woman to lust after her, you've already committed adultery in your heart. It would be easy for a young man to think that he keeps himself pure for a wife someday, which means he's just too shy to do anything with girls. So he stays at home and looks on the computer and gratifies himself. It's not just in Matthew 5, it's really in the Ten Commandments too, this issue of lust in a sense. The seventh commandment is you shall not commit adultery. Remember the 10th commandment, the last one? You shall not covet. What's listed there of things you shouldn't covet? Well, it says your neighbor's goods or your neighbor's wife. You shouldn't covet your neighbor's wife. You shouldn't covet your neighbor's hotter wife. You shouldn't want his wife, either as your wife, which would be coveting, or as your one-night stand, which would be coveting. It's just lust, what Jesus was talking about in Matthew 5. So this issue, Proverbs 5, 6, and 7, deals with seduction and flirtation and immodesty in women, but it also deals with adultery and immorality and lust, whether that is actual lust of an actual person or that's a virtual person through the TV or internet or a magazine. And this relates to boyfriend and girlfriend temptations, again, to push the envelope further in your physical interaction with each other. So I hope you see this is big, and don't think Proverbs 5 through 7 is talking about the guy at work who cheats on his wife with his secretary. It's not just that issue. There are other things here of sexual temptation that have a lot of relevance. Secondly, in your outline, dissecting the sexual concerns of men and women. We need to dissect the sexual concerns here of each man and woman. Now, two ingredients come together in these passages to make temptation truly tempting. It's a perfect storm. It's her beautiful seduction, her appearance, her setting, her actions, her words, but it's also the man's desire for beauty and sensuality and sexual pleasure. In other words, she's a temptress and he's horny. That's what's going on. This is a guy who's thinking with his loins, as we sometimes say. We usually don't say loins, but I'm being polite. I'm trying not to say too much today. So she's playing. You see that she's playing to his weakness. His weakness for female beauty and sensuality. We realize, of course, that this can go both ways. Men can be seductive. Women can be turned on by the appearance of a man. I guess women could be lured into bed because of his amazing abs. I don't have that problem. My wife, it's just inner beauty right here. She just... I used to tell my kids when they were younger, I tell them that, see that guy on TV, you know, it would be like a workout commercial, Bowflex or something like that. And I would say, look at those bumps, aren't those gross? It's weird, all those big bumps, look at me, how smooth. And for a while, I had them convinced that smooth was better and bumpy was bad. Now they know daddy's a fat wimp, but where was I? Proverbs is describing what's most common, right? It doesn't mean there aren't any exceptions to this rule, but generally, men are the guys who are the puppy dogs panting, and women are the teasing type who tempt men into trouble. Of course, it can go either way. And so if you find yourself, ladies, being very drawn to the way men look, feeling like you could be seduced simply by what a man says and what he looks like and whether he smells good or something like that. If that's the case, you need to read Proverbs 5 through 7, also putting yourself in the shoes of the man in this, because you'll find yourself in those temptation situations where you have to fight temptation, just like in this story, it's the young man fighting temptation of an adulterous woman. Why are some women harlots, loose, cheap, one-night stands, whatever you want to call them? Why do some women become promiscuous sexually? Especially when men are infamous for thinking with their loins, as I said. One explanation for female promiscuity from sociologists and psychologists that are both Christian and non-Christian is that oftentimes it's driven by a need to be accepted and loved. Oftentimes there's a dad in the home, or not a dad in the home, but if he is at home, he wasn't there to love his little girl like she should have been loved. And girls grow up desperate to fill that void. There's a lesson, I think, here for dads. Love your little girls. Saturate them with love and kisses and smother them so they don't feel like they need to find what God made them to need and enjoy and appreciate. Don't let them twist that and go someplace else for it. But it's not just this issue of the need for acceptance in love, also related to this issue of seduction or female promiscuity is power. That's the third point. Seduction is not just about sex, it's power. We've got to get to the root of this here. Sometimes when a woman is seductive, it's not just to get into bed for the pleasure of the sex alone. The battle of the sexes is far older than women's suffrage. It's far older than women's liberation movements. It goes back to the curse. Genesis 3, verse 16. This is what God said to Eve in the garden. Kind of confusing wording, but I think we can work it out. God said to Eve, "Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you." What is the desire for her husband? That almost sounds like it's a good thing, right? I think the best interpretation of this, though, is that that's not a good thing. This is the battle of the sexes. Your desire to overrule your husband will be met by his desire to rule over you. Now, why would desire be translated that way? Or why would desire mean not good desire? You like him, you'll be drawn to him, but bad desire to rule over him? Well, in chapter 4, verse 7, God used very similar language in warning Cain about sin. Genesis 4:7, sin is crouching at the door, God said. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. Almost the same Hebrew syntax there. Its desire is for you. What does that mean when sin desires you? It desires to overtake you. It desires to dominate you. But you should overtake it. You should master it. Ah, just like the wife and husband scenario of Genesis 3:16. Your desire will be to overtake your husband. But his desire will be to rule over you. Now, back in Proverbs, the power of seduction is highlighted in a lot of ways. It's not just seduction, and it's not just seduction unto sexual pleasure. There is a lot in this seduction that's about power. Let me show you. Proverbs 6, verse 25. Do not desire her beauty in your heart, nor let her capture you with her eyelids. Again, hunting language. Remember? Some commentators call her not the adulteress or the temptress, but the huntress. On account of a harlot, one is reduced to a loaf of bread. She'll devour you. You're a dumb loaf of bread, and she will eat you up. Adulteress, an adulteress hunts for precious life, it says in verse 26. Or look at chapter 7, verse 10. Behold, a woman comes to meet him, dressed as a harlot and cunning of heart. She's smooth. In verse 12, she lurks by every corner like a thief. In verse 13, she seizes him and kisses him like someone in the military or like a police officer. Seizes. She grabs him. She holds him. In verse 21, many are her persuasions. Flattering lips. She seduces him. He follows her as an ox who goes to the slaughter. There's a lot of power in there, right? Now, the battle of the sexes goes both ways, and there are plenty of times in history where men have suppressed women. There have been great stories in history of women rightfully fighting for the right to vote or for courts and police officers taking seriously their charge that their husbands are abusive instead of looking the other way. All those things are good, and Christians should cheer those, pray for those, and even seek to see those spread in this world in places like the Middle East where it is a horribly suppressive area for women. But sometimes women have wrongly reacted to this in doing Genesis 3:16 to desire to overcome man, man in general, man in society. Sometimes it is expressed with power at the root, but looking two different ways. One is feminism, just kind of overtaking by power, kind of raw feminism, not the good kind of feminism. But then there's also this other thing, seduction. It has the same root, power. Oh, the modestly dressed radical feminist looks way different than the bar-hopping, scantily clad woman, but both are motivated by power. Both are motivated by power. Modern-day marketing has tapped into this, no doubt, into this channel of power through sex. With guys, it's painfully obvious. How many beer commercials are more about boobs than beer? All? Right? I mean, it's just laughable. There's no correlation necessarily, except guys like beer, guys like boobs. Put them together, let's sell some beer. That's it. There's no correlation whatsoever. But they put them together because they know men are stupid. Have you seen this commercial for shaving cream where they're supposedly like microscopic girls, scantily clad girls in the shaving cream? And then when you rub it on your face, these girls, they have shaving cream shooters and they spray your whiskers. But then it turns into a cat fight and they start spraying each other. Have you seen this? That's only half the commercial. The other half of the commercial is, you know, because it smells good, how that gets to your nose. Well, scantily clad, pretty girls with jetpacks. Very small little girls with small jetpacks fly into your nose and have a party. It's so absurd. They show this. The guy looks like he has an enormous nose, but there's no way of telling because the girls are so small. Not sure which one is scale or not, but they fly in and they have a dance party. Guys, how do we fall for stuff like that? There's no disco ball in your nose. There are boogers. And older guys especially, they'd be tripping over your nose hair. And there are no microcosmic little girls that go dancing in your whiskers or your nose. But some guy on a couch, no doubt drinking beer, looks at that and goes, man, give me some of that shaving cream with the girls in it. You know? What did Proverbs say? He's a loaf of bread. He's getting devoured by the market, by commercials. He's a dumb animal that's led away to the slaughter. Ad agencies know this. We should know it too. We should see a commercial like that and quickly change it. But the first time you see it, you just can't believe girls flew in his nose. And so you keep watching it, unbelievably so. And when you see that commercial, you remember. They're tapping into something that's real. If you don't buy that shaving cream, it reminds you men are dumb in this area and you put no confidence in the flesh. If that kind of stuff sells shaving cream, it doesn't take much to sell you sex. Let's back up and remember that it wasn't always this way, though. This is something gone wrong. So the fourth point is that the problem is not sex, it's the corruption of sex. Remember in the garden, it wasn't good for Adam to be alone. God said it. So in the garden, God gave him Eve, bone of his bone, flesh of his flesh. God made him a partner, a life partner, and they were made to go together. They were made to be one flesh. What's one flesh mean? The uniting of emotions, sure. Uniting of possessions, no doubt. It's uniting of lives, of course. But not least, it's the uniting of their parts. Guys who work around tools or guys who play with nuts and bolts, you know that one's called male and one's called female. God made parts to go together beautifully and wonderfully. They were naked and unashamed. And their sex was a physical expression of their growing oneness of emotions and time together and love with each other and life together. God said this was all very good. Remember that? Behold, it's all very good. God was not surprised that they found out how to do that. God invented sex. God did not look down in the garden one day and say, what are they doing? Great. She found it. Well, I better put up some rules or they'll go crazy. So, give them some rules and I'll tell them it's for procreation. It's for making babies and we'll stick to that. No. Now, God invented sex, both the procreating part and the recreating part. The pleasure. God created the pleasure of sex. He made it beautiful and wonderful and intimate. And yes, he designed it for a man and a woman. Not Adam and Steve. Adam and Eve. Yes, it's man and woman. The parts go together like that. It tells you that that's the natural way. But more specifically, it's not just man and woman. It's designed for husband and wife. God didn't just say, here's a partner. And wait till you get more options. Think about this, guys. What if you, in your whole life, only saw one woman naked? Your wife. I know it's too late, but what if? What if? I know it's practically impossible, but what if? Remember Adam? In the garden, God says, see if you can find a partner. See if you can find a helper. See if you can find something that's suitable to you. And he has Adam name the animals, really what it's being said there is that he's categorizing the animals. He's seeing if any of them are a helper. None of them talk. None of them are sexy. You know, I mean, and then he wakes up from a sleep and there's naked Eve. You know, like he was thinking maybe the kangaroo was the best option. And then Eve, are you kidding? Can you imagine that's the only body you've seen? Wow. Maybe we should protect its purity as much as we can, not by, I don't know, going to a monastery, not by living in a bubble, but maybe the beauty of the marriage relationship is so precious, so powerful, so glorious, so joyful, as we'll talk about 2 weeks from now, that maybe it is worth being radical about how we protect eyes, even now. Remember that sin is the twisting of that which is good. So now, this side of sin, sex is outside of marriage. Sex is with other things than just women or just the opposite sex. It's often apart from commitment. It's often apart from any other kind of intimacy. And so twisting of sex means that we want to abuse it, or we want to deify it, we want to worship it, but it doesn't mean that it disappears. Remember, sin in this world means good things get twisted, not that good things disappear. So the goal is not to give up sex. The goal is to see it restored into the glorious place that God designed it to be. But what if you're not there yet? What if you're not married? Well, the fifth point is this: leave physical intimacy and passion for marriage. I want to talk mostly the unmarried people here right now, whether you're 12 or 18 or 24 or 48. Last week we talked about dating and courtship and what to look for in a spouse. But let's explore this issue today. How do you physically relate to that person that could possibly be the one you marry, or even is the one that you plan to marry? Maybe you're about to be engaged, or you are engaged. How do you relate physically to that person? How far is too far? What base is sin before marriage? Second base? Third base? As long as your slide is a little bit short of home plate? So somewhere between third base and home? I want to draw your attention to a passage you may not have thought in these terms, but I think is relevant. 1 Timothy 5, in verse 1, Paul tells Timothy how he should relate to other demographics in the church. So he says, don't rebuke an older man. Timothy, you're a young man. Don't rebuke an older man. Appeal to him as a father. Talk to him the way you talk to your father. To the younger men, treat them as brothers. The older women, treat them as mothers. We're the family of God. And the younger women as sisters in all purity. Why did he put that qualifier at the end, in all purity? Notice none of the categories have something after the kind of person you're talking about. So if it's father, or if it's mothers, or if it's brothers, it just stops and it goes on to the next category. You get to younger women, and Timothy's supposed to treat them as sisters with all purity. If the with all purity wasn't there, you might think that Paul's just saying to Timothy, remember that ladies in the church, younger ladies in the church, they're your sisters in the Lord. Treat them like sisters in the Lord. Care for them, protect them, and sometimes make out with them. No? No, with that last phrase there, with all purity, it can't be that, can it? It can't be impure. You treat them as a sister. I would dare say that I think Paul is getting at this issue. Timothy, if you wouldn't do it with your sister, you shouldn't do it with someone who's not your wife. if you wouldn't do it with your sister? I think Paul is drawing on the cultural taboo, almost universal cultural taboo of incest. You wouldn't do it with your sister? And you go, ooh, gross, no. What is she? Well, she's my girlfriend, my lady friend, my girl on the side, or what is that? What kind of category is that in Scripture? Well, there's no category for it. Either we're single and we're brothers and sisters, or we're married and now we're one flesh. And I would say also that this isn't just an issue of parts. We had a college pastor when Sarah and I were in college who did a series on this, and he said over and over, it's not an issue of parts, it's an issue of hearts. It's not an issue of what parts come in contact with which parts, so that can't touch there, and this shouldn't get lifted up here, and you shouldn't kiss there, or you shouldn't kiss like this. He said it's not an issue of what parts come in contact with what parts. It's an issue of hearts. The question is whether there's sexual passion and whether that is to be reserved for marriage. The question is not whether sex is reserved for marriage. The question is whether we should relate to any young lady with sexual passion outside of marriage. It's not just an issue of touching certain parts. I dare say that God's restrictions on sex and almost any other thing are for our good. For our good. For our enjoyment. And we'll see that in weeks to come. I've never, ever heard a married couple say, I just wish when we were, you know, dating and then engaged that we had done more. I just wish we had really, you know, gone further. I've never heard that, have you? I've never heard that. In fact, what I've experienced a lot of times in counseling young people who are trying to get married or pursuing marriage or their pre-engagement, when we talk about the physical stuff and I encourage them to break it off, quit being physical with each other, the relationship goes in one of two directions very fast. It either gets better because now they're getting to know each other, not just making out. They're actually talking. Or it gets worse, because now they find out they actually don't like the person apart from their body, apart from the fun that really you could have with anyone. Sixth, let me be specific to the ladies on this point. Ladies, avoid tempting men with flirtation and immodesty. The proverbial harlot in chapters 5 through 7 seduces him with words and with flirtation, with her looks, but not least with immodesty. She's dressed like she's looking for it. Now, there are different categories of seduction, female seduction in our culture. Some are more brazen and bold than others. Probably the most brazen and bold is the hooker, who's selling herself in the street. You know what she looks like, you know what she's doing. She'll even talk to you first. She'll ask you if you want it. She'll try to lure you in. But Proverbs isn't talking about that lady because there's no money exchanged here. The harlot in Proverbs is a tramp, a slut, one night stands, hookups. She's not a hooker. She's out to get some. Then there's this category, maybe more close to home for you, of the immodest flirt who's out to get a guy. So she's a bar hopper, she's clubbing, she doesn't know whether this will be a one-night commitment or a one-year commitment with this man, but she wants him. Then there's the girl who's seductively dressed and she's immodest and her clothes, her appearance give little leave little to the imagination, and she's not there to go out afterwards. She's not there to go home with someone afterwards. She's there for the attention. She's there for the desire to be liked. She's there for the power of jerking men's heads. Then you have another category of immodesty, dressing with tight clothes or exposed parts, and it's unintentional and maybe thoughtless in some ways. It's just done to fit in with friends, or it's just done because this is how they look nowadays. This is how tops look. But it still does the same thing as these other ones. It still sends a message of invitation. It still draws in. It still, in some ways, seduces. It's a lure. They're in the same family of temptation, you could say. I know they're not all as equally bad. But ladies, I want you to see that the way you dress isn't just a cultural issue. It's not just a cultural issue. Of course, we're all cultural here. We don't have wristbands that say, what would Jesus wear? And so we wear robes and sandals because we're just timeless. You know. Even, you know, robes and sandals are what they wore when Jesus was around. That's what he wore. So you wear kind of what's around you. But at some point, the culture may be dictating a kind of dress and a kind of exposure that runs contrary to God's purposes and his ways and his purity. And, ladies, your help of young men around you. So at the very least, immodest dress may mean that you distract young men. Or mean that they have to work harder to concentrate on right things and not wrong things. But it also may mean a stumbling block. A couple years ago, we did a modesty Saturday seminar. We called it Modesty, a Biblical Theology of Skin and Clothes. That's available at the Resource Center. It's also online for free for a download. And it's 3 hours on the issue of modesty. Probably 1 hour is on just what's going on culturally, what's around us, how do things develop culturally as far as dress and exposure. And then the other 2 hours are on this theme of nakedness and beauty, modesty and immodesty throughout Scripture. One of those passages is Proverbs 31, which we saw last week. Remember, Lemuel was supposed to be looking for a woman whose beauty was not empty, whose beauty was not vain. It wasn't deceitful. She had a beauty that was deeper than skin deep. Rethink true beauty, ladies. Rethink the whole concept. Oh, I'm about to go off on a tangent here, but I'll just introduce it and let you explore the topic on your own or around lunch. Here it is. Are you supposed to be pretty to everybody? You're supposed to be pretty to everybody. Why do we think that? Why do we think that women are supposed to be attractive to everybody? Why do we think that? Why do you think that you have to be pretty to anybody but your husband? Anybody but your husband. I don't know. Again, I better not go down that too far. But I encourage you, if this is an issue for you, if you're struggling with what it means and how to reflect modesty without legalism, then maybe that seminar would help you. The last thing here, seventh, men, flee seduction and fight temptation. Flee seduction. Fight temptation. The harlot in Proverbs 7 entices him with many persuasions, it says in verse 21. Let me show you a few. Look down at Proverbs chapter 7. And look at verse 19. Here's the appeal of, we won't get caught. My husband's not at home. He's gone on a long journey, and he's got a lot of money with him. And I know when he goes on his business trip with a lot of money, he never comes home early. We won't get caught. Nobody will know. In verse 16, oh, she's setting the stage. The conditions are perfect. The couch has silk coverings. That doesn't say silk, but that's what we would think of as kind of a sexy covering, seductive covering. I got silk sheets on the couch. These linens are from Egypt. That, I don't know if that would be alluring to you or not, but it probably would be to him. And her bed smells nice, and she's envisioning a romp. She's envisioning an all-night romp. Let us delight ourselves with caresses. You know what she's doing? She's painting the picture of Hollywood sex. I had a friend who got married 3 months before I did. He called me halfway through that summer, so a month and a half into his marriage, and he said, it's not like it is in Hollywood. I mean, you know, it's good, but it's not like, you know, legs flying, arms flying, you know, mad stuff, push the stuff off the table, wherever. He said, it's not like that. And he was right. It's sometimes like that, and that's great. But you know what? Wouldn't it be great if you only saw one girl naked? Wouldn't it be great if you only saw one couple in your whole life have ridiculous bedroom passion? And it was you and your wife, and that's it? That'd be great. It's tough, but I think we should be careful with what we see and then what we expect. She flatters him in verse 15. I've come to meet you, to seek your presence earnestly. Probably not. She's probably just looking like a desperate housewife looking for the lawn boy who's the cutest or something. By the way, can I just say something about desperate housewives while we're on it? Be careful about saturating your mind with any show where adultery is the norm or where adultery is the norm. We could just stop there. Be careful about that. Because you know what? Your marital bed might look boring. It might look boring if you get a steady diet of sexual relations through Hollywood. And it shouldn't look boring. Next week we'll talk more about the whole issue of fighting seduction and fighting temptation and keeping ourselves pure. But I want to say this at the end. Remember that this can be flesh and blood seduction. This can be a real person. But more common today and less risky is seduction that you could call e-seduction, electronic seduction, virtual seduction. Remember this, whether you're married or unmarried, there are two bank accounts you can make deposits in. Even if you're unmarried, you can make a bank account deposit into the married account and not the unmarried account. As you invest in the unmarried account, you deplete resources, even long term. You deplete resources in the married account. As you invest in the unmarried account of self-gratification, of virtual woman, or outside of marriage women. As you invest in those accounts, there is no way to compete. There's only so many funds to go around. If you're unmarried, you can invest in the marital, the glorious, free, beautiful, as God designed, sexual passion account. By right now guarding your lusts and not investing in any other account. As you don't invest in the unmarried account as a single man, you are investing in the married account someday when you get your woman. And as you're married, you invest in that married account. Don't go outside. Drink from your own water. That's what it says in Proverbs 5, and I can't wait to talk about that 2 weeks from now. But I want to say this too, that you might need to be honest and confess sin to your spouse. Maybe it starts with confessing it to a friend or to a pastor and getting their advice, and maybe they'll quickly say, you need to tell your spouse about that. Maybe guys, you shouldn't tell your wife every time you have any kind of temptation to lust. You'll tell her too much and scare her. Don't tell her every time. But at some point, things have got to change, right? At some point, this has gone on too long. No one knows about it. Pornography used to be this thing that was back alley, dark corner, and you'd park down the block and put your trench coat on, pull up the collar, go inside, look around, hope no one saw you, get your magazine, put it under your jacket maybe, get back in your car and drive away fast and hide it in the closet or wherever. It's all very back roads, all very shady. Now it's right in your living room, it's on your computer, it's so accessible, it's free, it's one click away. You just wait for no one to be home or you wait for no one to be at the office. Maybe you need accountability, maybe you just need to set up some boundaries. I had a season in my life where I asked Sarah, because I had my office at home on a personal computer, I didn't trust myself. And so I established certain websites that I went to all the time. And I could go to those automatically on my own. And I asked her that any time I had to go to a different website for her to come in the room and type in the password that I didn't know. I just didn't trust myself. He said, well, that's really extreme. And boy, that's slow surfing. I know, it was really inconvenient sometimes. But you know what? It was safe. Right then it was safe. And that might be the answer for you. It might be something radical. Remember Jesus said, if your right eye offends you, you should pluck it out rather than go to heaven, rather than go to hell with it? Maybe you need to give up the internet. Get rid of computers in your house. Maybe you need to talk to your teenage son. Maybe a teenage son here needs to finally ask dad for help and talk about this openly. The end of this path is death. That's what it says at the end of chapter 7. Her house is the way to Sheol. It looks good at first. You think you're not going to get caught, but if no one ever knows, and usually they do find out because it's so seducing and so encompassing and so much bondage in it, but even if no one ever found out what you've done, the Lord knows. In chapter 5, verse 20, why would you be exhilarated with an adulteress? The ways of man are before the eyes of the Lord. Her husband won't know? God knows. He was there. No one's home? God's home. I'm on a business trip. No one can find out. I get the bill at the end and I pay with cash. No one will know. God was there. He knows it. And you need not play with it unless you want to play with death. The death of your marriage, the death of health, and maybe even eternal death. But hear this gospel. I want you to repent as hard as you need to, as much as is relevant to your situation right now. But if you're a Christian, I want you to hear that the gospel is greater than your sin. The gospel is greater than pornography. The gospel is greater than adultery. The gospel is greater than weird kinky sex outside of marriage. The gospel is greater than rape. The gospel is greater than an abortion. So bow with me if you would and hear this gospel from Hebrews chapter 4. Like Proverbs 5, this section begins with the fact that the Lord knows, He sees. There is no creature hidden from His sight, but all things are open and laid bare to the eyes of Him with whom we'll give an account. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who passed through the heavens coming down to us, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. He sees all, He knows all, but don't you give up your confession. Keep confessing that He came down to save. We have a high priest who not only came down to save, but He sympathizes with our weaknesses. He's been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. He even has compassion on our temptation. And yet He was without sin. Oh, that's our hope. We're thankful for the sympathy that He was tempted like we've been tempted. Of course, that means tempted even sexually. Truly tempted. We're thankful for that sympathy, but we are also, we are more thankful that when He was tempted, He was without sin. Therefore, draw near with confidence to the throne of grace. You can come to the throne of grace. Leave your sin at His throne of grace and come with confidence to again know His mercy and grace.